Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Friday, December 4th. So how much shutting down is the right response to the record coronavirus deaths and hospital demand that we're seeing right now? How much does it hurt when Democratic Party politicians don't practice what they preach about not traveling and avoiding crowds? What's the right order for distribution of the coronavirus vaccine? And how should public health officials deal with the weirdly opposite challenges of telling some people they can't get vaccinated yet and convincing others to take the shots at all if they're opposed to it? These latest pandemic challenges come as the daily national death rate from the virus topped 3,000 people a day the last few days for the first time since the pandemic began. Think about it. That happens to be about the same number of people who were killed on 9/11. We're now experiencing a 9/11 every day in terms of Americans getting killed. But unlike 9/11, this is no surprise attack, right? We know the enemy and the sacrifices that are needed to stop the slaughter. We're at a moment when patriotism meets public health. Are enough of us capable of enlisting in the army of personal responsibility and smart public policy to ward off the worst of this attack? With me now is Dr. Derek Kass, emergency medicine physician at the Columbia University Medical Center and a Yahoo News medical contributor. Dr. Kass, thanks for joining us again. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's a pleasure, Brian, always.
Let me start with the new wave of closings that are being ordered and this idea of patriotism meeting public health. Joe Biden said yesterday he would ask the country to wear masks when in the company of people outside their households for his first 100 days in office as president, and that could make a significant difference. I don't know if many more people will do it than are doing it today, just based on that, given the polarization around the issue. But do you think that could make a significant difference?
So I know that if it works, it will make a huge difference, right? We know masks work for stopping the spread of this virus, not just for the person who may be infected from spreading it, but also the person wearing the mask from getting it. We have data that shows that if you are wearing a mask and somebody around you, for example, coughs near you or has the virus, you are both less likely to get the virus and less likely to get a severe form of the virus. And so any more mask wearing that we can get anywhere in America will absolutely improve our fight against this virus, our decrease our transmission and decrease our hospitalizations and death rate. Yeah, absolutely.
Biden is not contemplating a national mask mandate. And it seems to me that even the local mandates are mostly unenforceable. Could appealing to people left and right as a matter of patriotism have a place alongside shutdowns of things and stay-at-home orders?
Absolutely. I think that, one of the things we're seeing from the president-elect, and I think a lot of the governors that have tried to enforce mandates statewide with the best intentions, is that, even mandates are only as good as enforcement. And if you can't enforce things, then it's like a piece of paper without any heft. And so political will, or more importantly, public health will and community engagement is critically important at any of the recommendations or mandates we put out. So I am optimistic that although I can't see the president-elect putting in a federal mask mandate across all states, he can enforce it on federal property. He can enforce it for interstate travel. He can model this behavior and encourage bipartisan support from the Senate and Congress to show that mask wearing on federal property is mandated, but also that these senators and governors from both parties should be modeling a behavior at their state level.
Let me get your reaction to what California is doing now, because this has implications for everywhere as cases and hospital bed shortages and deaths continue to rise. California is ordering things closed like they haven't since the spring, for certain areas of the state at least, where ICU bed availability has dropped below 15%. That's their threshold, including no outdoor dining and roping off playgrounds. In LA, they don't even want people walking or bicycling with people not from their own households for the next few weeks, from what I've read. What's your opinion about closing outdoor things, since experience seems to show being outdoors is very protective in general against spreading or catching the virus?
So I think that what's happening in California, and remember, the metric they're using to start all this is critical hospital capacity. We're seeing an exponential spread of this virus in every single state, basically. And the hospital capacity, we know, is going to continue to get crunched. And there's a lag once hospitalizations start at this level from the time that people can get discharged from the hospital, because this disease has such a prolonged and unpredictable course once you've reached that critical level. So I think that what they're really doing is going back to a stay-at-home order. And it's because every single infection runs the risk of taking another one of those ICU beds. You know, we saw, obviously, in New York, when we had our surge in March and April, we were able to flex up to a huge number of ICU beds, converting all of our, you know, ambulatory care centers, a lot of our recovery rooms into ICUs. But really, very few other areas of America have that capacity. So I think that although this does feel draconian in a lot of ways, right, very dramatic, because they are taking even the safest gatherings and stopping those, I think it's really for the fear that if somebody needs an ICU bed and is critically ill, there will be no place to put them. And that itself, that unnecessary death, the idea that somebody would have nowhere to go, is the bar that they're hitting against to say, we now have to close basically every place that the virus could spread, even if it's a very, very low risk.
Well, is there data on this? Is the virus spreading in playgrounds, and is the virus spreading in social gatherings that people have with social distancing and masks outdoors?
No. So, right. So I think that that's exactly right. I think that I think, like I said, it is as far as they can go to short of saying stay home and do not leave your home. And so I think that they are unsure how far they have to go to stop this ICU spread, the risk of losing their bed. So I do think it's a bit far, but I also know that when you're looking down the pike of having to tell people that there is no place for them, right? If they're in an ambulance and trying to come to the hospital, you start to look to as many places as you can spread even one case of this virus.
Yeah.
And so I think we're in a very difficult place, and the decisions become very difficult to make. And I just, the better people are at following the other guidances, the more likely those parks and outdoor dining will get to be opened again very, very soon.
Maybe they just figure, like, if you give people an inch, they'll take a mile.
We see that all the time. Yes.
How damaging is it, in your opinion, as a doctor, that liberal Democratic politicians keep getting caught in virus behavior hypocrisy? You've probably seen these stories. Governor Gavin Newsom eating with 12 people at a fancy restaurant in California and having to apologize. Governor Andrew Cuomo planning to have some people over for Thanksgiving from other households in his family, but other households, and canceling that when he got called out. The mayor of Denver told his city not to travel for Thanksgiving, but then flew out of state himself. He got caught and apologized. The mayor of Austin attended a wedding with 20 people while he had a 10-person capacity rule in effect. Then he flew to Mexico for a vacation and posted a video from there telling people not to travel. That mayor issued a public apology too. All liberal Democrats who've all been at odds with the president's more or less laissez-faire public policy. How damaging is it to the effort to get people to comply?
Look, I think it's damaging. And I think that, it's not, these are not both sides, right? So each of these leaders made a bad choice, and they made a bad choice amongst the other choices that they're making. And I'm not excusing it, but I think that we make choices every single day. And when you're a leader, you just don't have the room to make bad choices, right? You know, Governor Cuomo having his mother over when asking people not to have elderly people, you know, in their homes, or Governor Adler going to an island and posting a video saying stay home while he's at an island. These are poor form choices, and they are bad examples. They are not, however, deliberate flouting of public health response like we're seeing at the White House when they're having, you know, 40 unmasked Christmas parties while the CDC is saying don't gather with people outside your house. So I want to make sure that although it is true that we should not be seeing these bad choices be not just publicized but exist, because it is important that our leaders lead by example across the board, I don't want to deteriorate into this idea that it is now even on both sides. We have governors like Ron DeSantis in Florida that is saying not just he won't put in a state mandate for masks, but he won't even support any communities or cities having their own mask mandate. So it's very important that we keep our eyes straight ahead and say each of these leaders has made a mistake. They have apologized. But remember that every day we make choices around the spread of this virus. And these are hard choices. So when your mother-in-law, like mine did, asks you to come over for Thanksgiving and you try to convince her not to, but she comes and she knows the risks, at some point you have to somehow acknowledge that that is the choice somebody is making for their own life. And we have to continue to try to make better choices every single day. But it just reinforces to me how difficult so many of these choices are that we are making every single day and why we are so exhausted from these choices.
There's also, I think, a matter of what lesson we should take from these hypocritical Democratic Party politicians. Because when I watch Fox, they point out the hypocrisy, which is fair, and they should. But then they shrug as if to say, you see, those control freak elected officials shouldn't be asking us regular people to be making sacrifices that they won't make themselves. We shouldn't have to do this. That's the implication. When the real message should be those politicians are hypocrites, we should all be taking preventive behaviors. I'm curious if you see the damage in those terms.
I definitely see the damage. And this is the problem we're living with right now, is that, like you said, if you give people an inch, they take a mile. If they see one crack in the system, they then take the whole house down. And the problem with this virus and the transmission is that every decision matters. You know, if you're with a friend in a car and you're both wearing masks, that is better than being in a friend with a car and being unmasked. So if we saw a politician in a car with people unmasked, that would be a poor decision that would have, you know, repercussions going forward. So I totally agree that you have to be on your best game all the time if you're in a position of leadership, you know, as far as decision making for this virus, because it gives fodder for anybody willing to undermine the system. Once they see one crack, they will take in the entire structure down.
Let's take a phone call. Chris in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Dr. Derek Kass. Hi, Chris.
Oh, hi. Hi, Brian. Hi, Dr. Kass. Thank you very much for having this conversation. I'm an essential worker. I started my essential work in December of 2019, perfect time. And I did get sick in March. I was tested positive around May or June for antibodies. So, yeah, I got a vested interest in this. And honestly, I think about the vaccine like I think about so many things. Opportunity, education. These are things that have been compromised. You know, they were supposed to be for everybody, and it was supposed to be a fair shot. Vaccines, when there's not enough, our first instinct to say, yeah, let's make it fair. But it shouldn't be fair, because we have super spreaders. We have wealthy, entitled people. Put any other filter on that as you want, and they're the ones spreading. So why, when they get it, after flouting the rules, should we not fine them and then say you have to take the vaccine because you're a problem? And everybody around you is a problem.
Ah, you're identifying Chris, thank you very much. And you're identifying, Dr. Kass, he is identifying what I called at the top, this sort of weirdly opposite challenge or set of challenges, pair of challenges, of telling some people that they can't get vaccinated yet and convincing others to take the shots at all if they're opposed to it. What a funny position to be in.
Yes, I think that the vaccination campaign, you have kind of two issues with the vaccine rollout, right? You have both an operational system that is overwhelming, right? You have a very unstable vaccine that's going to be required very interesting storage, and it's two shots, and there's some side effects. And so there's a huge lift operationally to delivering this vaccine. And so there's going to be a very deliberate rollout of who can get it, when, and how, while you also have to keep everyone in the background excited about getting the vaccine. You have to address their anxieties about vaccine, both for their community and for themselves personally and their families. You have to remind them that when they, you know, you have to kind of match when they're ready to get the vaccine, when it's available to them. Because if you've actually dispelled those anxieties and they're ready to go, but it's not ready for them for the next, you know, 2 months, then you have to re-engage them again as it gets closer. So these two campaigns, this operational campaign and this public messaging and trust campaign, have to be done very deliberately and actually completely intertwined in a way that we've never done before. I mean, certainly not since, you know, post-World War II, anything of this scale that's going to require public and private partnerships, community leaderships, faith leaders, you know, private industry, public health, all together working to really address this pandemic's end.
Will you get an early vaccine if you're eligible early as a healthcare provider? Because if you're an emergency room doc, I think you're going to be in the first wave.
So I am actually, I would get it live in person as soon as humanly possible. Absolutely. I think that it is really exciting that our technology and our innovation and our federal support has gotten us this vaccine this quickly. There's a lot of reasons why it happened this way. But I think that if we can all be examples to our communities of believing that we can be part of the solution, part of this newly immune army of people that can help protect the citizens that are further down the line, then yes, absolutely, I'll get it early.
You know, Politico New York has a story today that quotes an emergency room nurse at Mount Sinai who says about the feeling among her colleagues, quote, "Thus far, it's been a unanimous hell no. Why are we going to be the guinea pigs? We're the suicide squad. Isn't it enough we were stuck on the front lines?" And that's just a quote from one nurse, but it is a quote from one nurse at Mount Sinai. And about 20% of the 920 physicians polled by the Medical Society of the State of New York said they had reservations about getting the vaccine. So do you think that's consistent with your own knowledge of your own colleagues at your own hospital?
Well, I think that, you know, again, 20% is hesitant means 80% are ready to go. And that is actually what we need to achieve to start seeing some effects in each community for protection for this virus. We need to acknowledge that people have hesitance about vaccines in general, this vaccine specifically. I also think that once we have new federal leadership and better leadership at the FDA and the CDC, that people feel comfortable are continuing to be depoliticized, that we'll start to see vaccine confidence go up. I also think that a lot of things about this mRNA vaccine and how it's delivered and why it hasn't been done before, people need to understand what about this makes it probably more safe and effective than anything we've seen before, having to do with the delivery of the vaccine and why this technology hadn't been used. So I think it's really about public education, even amongst the healthcare community, to feel comfortable that, no, we're not guinea pigs as much as we are leaders. And the opportunity here is to lead by example, which means that we will get protected early on to protect ourselves and our citizens.
Nick in Cleveland, you're on WNYC with Dr. Derek Cass. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Brian. Big fan. I just wanted to ask, my mom's a flight attendant, and she's doing her annual required training. And my father is older. He has COPD, and she's going to be coming back tomorrow. He lives in, like, an in-law suite that my grandma used to live in the back of the house. But I'm worried about ventilation. I know she wants to quarantine apart from him just to make sure he's safe. But I'm wondering, like, when it comes to ventilation and everything, like, what can we do to be safest, to, you know, protect him?
So just to kind of jump into that. So if she's coming back from traveling and you want to protect them from each other, you're already doing the safest thing, which is to put them in two different spaces for the duration of time. The CDC has now said that you can actually stop a quarantine from exposure for 10 days. So if they're apart for 10 days, the ventilation itself doesn't matter as long as if they're not in the same space. If they're going to choose to be together, then you would just want to have the windows open and them still be far apart. And again, if they're wearing masks when they're together, that adds another layer of protection that allows the risk of your mother being an asymptomatic carrier to not get to your father.
Great. Well, thank you so much. That was what I was concerned about was the ventilation, and that really put my mind at ease. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Thank you very much, Nick. Part of your own story I've read is that when you got the virus, you actually practice social distancing within your own household, right?
Yes, very much so. My husband and I, we had moved our kids out of the house because I was so uncertain about this virus and I have an immune compromised child. But we had practiced social distancing in our house before I got the virus because I was worried of being an asymptomatic carrier at work. And so we were sleeping in different bedrooms. We actually were fortunate enough to use different bathrooms and we were not eating together at all. When I got sick, we lived our life very much like I tell people to, which is that I wore an N95 mask in my own house outside of my bedroom. We never ate together. We wiped down surfaces between if I went into the kitchen, I wiped down my surface after I left. But it's important to practice social distancing at home as best as you can, especially if somebody in your family has this virus. One of the things I will say is I've heard a lot about people, if they live together and somebody is positive for the virus, then they're getting some advice sometimes, well, it doesn't matter, you've all been exposed. And I have a problem with that because every day that you are negative but exposed is another day you have a chance to not get this virus. So if somebody in your family is positive for the virus and is living with you, everything you do to just put some space between that person and anyone that is currently either asymptomatic or negative helps stop the spread of this virus, which is what we're trying to do.
Before you go, actually, one question on schools and one question on Trump. Since we were just talking about vaccines and the timing, does President Trump deserve some credit, in your opinion, for his Operation Warp Speed? We know he's been so counterproductive to encouraging public health behaviors in so many ways during this, you know, preferring his magic bullet approach of hyping vaccines and hydroxychloroquine and things like that. But did his Operation Warp Speed program, because he was so focused on the magic bullet, contribute to these various vaccines being ready this fast? Or would the pharmaceutical companies have done it like this anyway?
The answer is yes, he helped us get here this fast. And I will say that with the knowledge that that came with a massive American sacrifice. And I think that we could acknowledge both things at the same time. The unilateral focus on therapeutics and vaccinations with an overwhelming financial support and the guarantee that we were going to purchase vaccine doses, which gave the industry comfort that they were having less financial risk in the production of these vaccines early on, which is why we can deliver it so quickly, no doubt accelerated the timeline for the delivery of this vaccine to people's arms, assuming it gets approved. But that must have an asterisk, that choice was made against virtually every single public health measure that would have prevented an overwhelming number of people dying, including the 3,000 people that died yesterday.
Yeah. And lastly, on schools, and we have a minute left, we've gotten everybody's opinion on this, so we'll get yours. In Michigan, Governor Whitmer is now ordering high schools and colleges to halt in-person classes. Here in New York, elementary school classes reopen next Monday, despite the rising positivity rate. Does the data show that little kids spread the virus to their teachers less, and high school and college students spread it more because you can't stop teenagers from socially gathering?
Right. The answer is yes. The data supports the idea that investing in K through 5, even K through 8 education as in-person learning is safe for teachers and students. And that when you get through over the age of 12, middle high schoolers, and certainly to college students, that the risk ratio, it stops being beneficial necessarily for the spread. And we should focus on especially since they do so much outside of schoolwork, right? So it's the aggregation and the congregation outside of school of these students that brings the risk back in. It's not the school environment that's always a risk for spread. It's the fact that these are kids that mobilize themselves separate from their families more, right? Second graders don't generally go out to the park and hang out with their friends without a mask or supervision. And unfortunately, high schoolers do. So I agree with both the Michigan decision and the New York decision to focus on elementary education for both social emotional learning and for academic learning. Absolutely.
Dr. Dara Kass, emergency physician at the Columbia University Medical Center and a Yahoo News medical contributor. Thanks for so much detailed information and answering so many questions from the callers and from me. We'll keep doing this. Thank you so much.
No problem. Bye. Have a good day.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.